And then I'll use all of Genesis chapter 31 to support what that application looks like. Okay? It's the easiest way that I can think of for us to get over it here this morning. As we look for the next 2 weeks here, Genesis 31 and 32, I find myself going back to Genesis chapter 28 an awful lot. Much of what you see being lived out, much of what you see being carried out for Jacob and the interventions that are taking place in Jacob's life, come back to promises that God made to him back in Genesis chapter 28. They are absolutely pivotal. They are foundational. Even as we start to consider the amount of angelic presence that is taking place here over the next couple chapters here, you find yourself going back to chapter 28 and thinking about these angels that are descending and ascending. There's an awful lot of tie-ins that are meant to be brought together here this morning. And as I look at chapter 31 in particular, my mind goes back to Genesis chapter 28 and verse 15. So if you're there, read with me very quickly here. Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. As you get to chapter 31, as we look at chapter 31 here this morning, there are a multitude of problems that are besetting Jacob, that are besetting Jacob's family, that are besetting Rachel. And one of the questions that arises, the central question that arises from this chapter as we look at it, is God able to preserve this family? Is God able to preserve Jacob? Is God able to preserve Rachel despite all of the pressures that are up against them? Despite the fact that individuals have the power to do something against them, to do them harm. Despite the fact that there are a number of ways in which this whole show can just simply fall off the track and into a ditch and a heartbeat. There are so many challenges that are arrayed against them. Is God able to preserve? He said that he would. He said that he wouldn't leave you until I had finished what I had promised for you. But is he able to do that? We struggle sometimes with thinking about that in the good times, don't we? We don't think about him at all, hardly, in that case, right? We don't even consider him to be necessary, right? I don't pray about times that are good. I don't pray for situations that are good. I almost forget him entirely. But then what about the situations that are difficult, right? What about Jacob's situation here? Will he continue to trust God? And will that trust that he finds in God that he has developed so far, will that continue to sustain him? Jacob has a number of trials yet to come, even though his name has changed to Israel and there is a fundamental change that takes place in his life. Will he continue to do that? Will he be okay going down to Egypt later on in the future? Will God really bring him back? What about the children of Israel later on? Right? Is God ever going to bring them out of the land of Egypt? 400 years? Will he forget? Will he be able to conquer Pharaoh and his armies? Will he be able to sustain them as they go through the wilderness? What about you and I, right? What about promises that God has made to us in our lives, right? Is God able to show himself strong in the situations that we face? When illness strikes us, when difficult family situations strike, when financial burdens begin to descend on us, is God able to preserve? Is he able to deliver? Is he able to bring us through? What about in terms of persecution? Right? What if it comes to death? Is he able to preserve? Is he able to bring us through? This is the fundamental question in chapter 31. As these pressures mount on Jacob, as these pressures mount on his family, the thing that you and I walk away with and should walk away with is that God is in fact able to do all of those things. He is able to preserve his individuals, those who trust in him. He is able to preserve his people. He is able to bring them through. There is not a situation, there is not a person who presents too great of a challenge for him. And God does it over and over and over and over again in this chapter. Four times we'll look at here this morning, four times in which God will preserve his people in the middle of difficult situations, even when they've brought it on themselves. He is able to do that. And that's the takeaway here this morning. So as we spend the rest of this time thinking through the preservation, as we spend the rest of our time thinking through this story, understand that is the point of all of this.
The point is not that this is an interesting story. The point is not that there's a real slow chase that takes place and that's real interesting. The point is not there's a covenant that gets made. Those are all simply supporting elements to bring you to one central conclusion, that God is someone who can be trusted, that he is powerful enough to deliver his people, that he is faithful to his word to keep his word. That is what chapter 31 is meant to bring us to. Okay, so let me go. Turn with me, if you would, to chapter 31. Let me read three verses, and then we'll open with a word of prayer, and then we'll go from there. Chapter 31, verse 1. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, "Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what all belonged to our father he has made all this wealth." Jacob saw the attitude of Laban. Behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." Let's pray. Father, we thank you for Scripture. Father, we thank you that Scripture is here for our edification. I thank you that it is here to teach us, to instruct us. Father, it is easy to look at these narratives as simply stories that existed. It's sometimes easy perhaps to not believe that some of these things occurred the way that they did. You certainly see many people coming to these and viewing them as stories. But Father, we come to the Scriptures recognizing them as truth, recognizing these as simple examples of how you have interceded in the past, how you act, what your character looks like, what your attributes are like, Father. And as we learn those things, as we see you in action, Father, it is meant to instruct us. It is meant to cause us to trust in you, Father, through our own difficult circumstances. It is meant to be used by us as encouragement to other believers, Father, as they go through these difficult circumstances, to say, "Don't you remember when?" Father, that is what these are here for. And so I pray this morning that as we look at these, at this story, as we look at all the things that are taking place and all the interactions and all the conversations and all the back and forth that takes place, Father, that we don't lose what is the central focus, and that is that you are a God who is faithful and you are a God who is powerful enough to be able to preserve his people. So give us grace this morning to see that, to feel that, Father, and to walk away with a renewed sense of that here this morning. We ask all this in your precious name. Amen. So Genesis chapter 31, we follow very closely on the heels of Genesis chapter 30. In fact, it's kind of difficult to know exactly what the time frames are looking like as we're going into chapter 30, into chapter 31. Inside of chapter 30, we saw that there's an awful lot going on in chapter 30 by itself, isn't there? There's a lot of sons that are being born. There's a lot of conflict that is taking place between Jacob's family, between all these two wives and the two concubines and all the sons. There's an awful lot of conflict that is taking place just inside of Jacob's family, and it's hard to watch, isn't it? It's hard to imagine being in that situation. It's hard to imagine having that being what day-to-day life actually looks like. On top of that, there's conflict between Jacob and Laban. Right, there has been an ongoing conflict that has been taking place that really has been stretching back for quite a long time, hasn't it? You think back, all that Laban has already done to Jacob, the core deception that takes place between Rachel and Leah, and surely there is simply everything is simply building, right? And you start to see that coming into a climax here into chapter 31, as in many ways Jacob is getting some things off of his chest when it comes to the way that he deals with Laban, right? There's a lot of pressure that has taken place. Much of what is taking place in chapter 30 is probably happening simultaneously. Right, Jacob has served 7 years for Rachel, then has to serve another 7 years for her again, right, and then continues on with Laban there on out. And this is when we see these pay changes that are taking place here, right? As we see that there's this deal that is struck, the fact that I will give you these striped ones, these odd ones that are existing over here, the solid ones remain with Laban, and this deal becomes is set, and a lot of that is probably taking place at the same time. We notice that Rachel finally has a child in verse 22 of chapter 30. And that is probably one of the kickoff points that would bring us into chapter 31, is the way that I read this story, right? As a lot of these things are happening simultaneously, as a lot of children are being born in fairly rapid fire, this is all happening around the same time. And probably it is Rachel's finally having a child that's probably beginning to kick off much of what we have in 31. Not only that, but we have Jacob becoming a wealthy man. We saw this as we left off in verse 43, right? We see that so the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks and female and male servants and camels and donkeys. Everything that Laban has arranged for, this little arrangement that Laban has set Jacob onto, was meant to hurt Jacob. It was not meant for Jacob to prosper. That was not good faith on Laban's part. It was meant to give Jacob something, right? We've got to give Jacob something, and we probably should give Jacob something, right? Because as long as we've kept Jacob, we've been prospering. So we kind of need to keep him around, but we don't want him to leave us, right? So we need him to have just enough, but not too much. And that was what this deal was meant to arrange. Instead, this has worked spectacularly the opposite direction. Right? Instead of Jacob staying poor, instead of Jacob just getting a meager return for his effort, Jacob is prospering. Right? He's doing very, very well for himself. And he's growing and he's becoming wealthier and wealthier. And as we go into chapter 31, that's not going unnoticed. Right? Laban can see what's going on. Laban apparently has sons at this point. We've not seen Laban has any sons. So presumably Laban has had sons as all these events have been going around. And Laban's sons are taking a look at the situation. They're saying, "Now we don't like this. Our father was the one that was wealthy. Our father had all of these possessions. And slowly but surely, Jacob is eroding into all of our possessions," right? As those striped animals become more numerous, as the spotted animals become more numerous, there seems to be less and less of these solid animals that are running around. And those are our things. And so the perception becomes, instead of Jacob being a kind of a good luck charm, as it were, for Laban and for the family, Jacob is becoming a bit of an albatross to Laban and his family, something that needs to be gotten rid of, something that is eating into the family inheritance and not a situation that we're enjoying at all. It's possible that maybe Laban's sons are the ones that are kicking this off. We see them are chatting, and maybe Laban is listening to them and finally coming around to their conclusion of yes indeed, this is becoming a situation that is not good. And so Jacob in verse 2, he sees that the attitude of Laban was not friendly as it was formerly. Laban doesn't enjoy Jacob quite as much as he used to, right? Jacob was good for something. Now we're not so sure that Jacob is good for anything. And this begins to cause some concern for Jacob. And I think the primary cause of Jacob's concern is going to be the fact that Laban could take away his wives and send him away empty-handed. This seems to be the primary fear of Jacob as everything has gone away. And I think you can see this even going into back to chapter 30. In chapter 30, he says in verse 25, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and to my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me depart, for you yourself know my service, which I have rendered for you." Right? Send me away. Let me go with my wives. Let me go with my children. And what has Laban resisted so far? Sending him away and sending him away with his wives and his children. Right, I think that's primarily why it was so important for Rachel to have a child by this point in time. If Rachel had not had a child, it might have been easier for Laban to say, "All right, you can take Leah, you can take Bilhah, you can take the other one. I'd like to hold on to Rachel myself." Right, and I think there's a concern that has been mounting in Jacob's mind that this could be what Laban will do. Laban could turn me into an indentured servant. Laban can simply turn me out then without anything to my name, and his children stay with Laban, and his wives stay with Laban, and Jacob comes away empty-handed despite all of these years of service, right? Jacob becomes concerned. Jacob becomes fearful, and we'll see this come out again. Jacob is very concerned. In the middle of this, in verse 3, comes a revelation from God to Jacob, right? After all of these years, there's been seemingly no revelation by God to Jacob during this period of time. It's not to say that there wasn't, simply to say that we don't have anything. But here, all of a sudden, out of the middle of nowhere, comes a revelation to Jacob. In verse 3, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." This is probably what Jacob has been waiting to hear for quite some time, right? Jacob has spent his time serving. Jacob is now dealing with a situation that is becoming increasingly unfavorable to him, and he's probably starting to itch. He's probably starting to wonder about going back home. This had never been the plan, had it? Jacob was simply meant to go back to Laban to find a wife. Jacob was never meant to spend this many years over in this part of the world. right? He's meant to go back to where his inheritance is. He's meant to go back to his father. Now, he's probably comfortable being over here because Esau is not over here. But apart from that, this was never the plan, right? And so Jacob, no doubt, has been wondering for quite some time, should I go back? When do I go back? And God finally here in verse 3 gives him the green light. It's time to go. Go back to your family. Go back to the land where you belong, right? And so Jacob begins to put this, the pieces together here. The first thing that he does is he begins to secure approval with his wives that to make sure that this is going to take place. You see this in verse 4. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field and said to them, I see your father's attitude, that it is not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I have served your father with all my strength. Yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. If he spoke thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth speckled. And if he spoke thus, the striped shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth striped. Thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. And it came about at the time when the flock were mating that I lifted up my eyes and I saw in a dream, and behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob. And I said, here I am. And he said, lift up now your eyes and see all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth. Rachel and Leah said to him, do we have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he has sold us and also entirely consumed our purchase price. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you. In verse 4, Jacob is beginning to try to make the case to his wives that they need to leave. God has told him to leave in verse 3. But if Jacob is going to leave, he needs to make sure that his wives are on board with this. Right? They're kind of an integral part of this family at this point in time. What if his wives decide that it would be better to stay with Laban? This is where they know, right? They've never been to the land of Canaan before. They don't understand what they're going into. This is a long journey that's ahead of them, right? They have to drag all of those children along with them. They're going to have to live uncomfortably for quite some time until they make it to the land of Canaan. Who knows what you're going to find once you get into the land of Canaan? Remember Esau is still there. Remember that he's been gone long enough. Who knows what else has changed in the land at this time? There could be other strange peoples that have come into the land. There seems to be an influx that happens from time to time there, right? So in order to make sure that everyone is on board with this, to make sure that Jacob can make this happen, he calls his wives to him and tries to present this idea to them secretly. You notice that he calls to them out to the field. Right, he's trying to get away from any prying ears. Right, he doesn't want anyone to know what's going to take place. I think Jacob at this point is already convinced that this escape is going to have to be just that. It's going to have to be an escape, right? And it's going to have to take place without Laban knowing. I think Jacob has some sense that that is the way this is going to have to take place, right? And so he brings them out to the field, away from any servants who could be listening, away from anyone else who might have a vested interest in this, and begins to convince them that this is what needs to take place. And I find this interesting because as you hear Jacob presenting this argument, I don't know how much to trust, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't completely trust Jacob still at this point in time. Jacob says some things that I think are right, but whether Jacob believes them or not is another story entirely, right? He begins by opening with the fact that he has done everything right as far as he is concerned, right? Which is always a good point to start off with. Verse 6, you know that I have served your father with all my strength, right? I have been the exemplary servant of your father for all these years. Now, I think there's a lot of truth to that to some degree, right? Even when Jacob is defending himself later on, talking about all the hardships that he has gone through, Jacob seemingly has done a very good job for Laban and has done well by him. So I think there's probably an element of truth to that exists here, right? But doubtless Jacob is also probably trying to present himself in the best possible light and to take Laban and put himself in the worst possible light, because we're about to do something really rough to Laban and we need to make you know that you're on my side, right? So he starts off with this very strong, look at me, I've done a really great job. And then he calls their attention to the fact that that Laban is no longer looking at him favorably in verse 5. And then in verse 7, he says, your father has cheated me. Your father has cheated me. And he says here, he changed my wages 10 times. Okay? Now, this is difficult to understand whether that really is true or not. The author of Genesis is not giving us everything. Okay, the author of Genesis never gives us everything. It's quite possible, and I think it's likely, that Laban has changed Jacob's wages at least several times, right? We certainly have every reason to think that he would. He certainly started off doing that with Rachel and Leah, did he not? All right, so if you take that as a foundation, it's rational to accept the fact that Laban has probably continued to try to give Jacob the wrong end of the stick, right, over and over again. Now, whether Laban has done it 10 times, that seems like an awful lot, does it not? So perhaps this is Jacob simply making a point that Laban has stiffed me quite a few times. 10 times? I don't know. Do you trust Jacob? Do you not? I don't really trust him. But I accept it as a fact that because of Laban's dealings with Jacob have not been good, right? And so Laban has been probably trying to change the prices here. And you see here that it seemed like the wages go back and forth between the speckled, between the striped, between the mottled, all of which were included in chapter 30. So it makes you wonder, has Jacob been entirely truthful with his wives, exactly what was going on in chapter 30? It's hard to say. Right? But the point is that Laban has been cheating us, right? Laban has not been giving us the right end of the stick, and that impacts his wives. Right? They are his wives, right? As Jacob prospers, they prosper. So if Laban has been cheating Jacob, who else has he been cheating? He's been cheating the wives. He's been cheating the children, right? Do you want to deal with a cheating grandfather? Of course you don't want to deal with a cheating grandfather, right? You can see where this argument is being built, right? What should we do? What is the right course of action? Your father hasn't been very good to us and doesn't like us at all. So we should do something about this. He then goes even farther, and this is the part that I find the most amazing here. In verse 12, he says, lift up now your eyes and see that all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled, for I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. Jacob admits that the reason why the speckled, the spotted, and the mottled have been increasing has been because of God's providence to him. It's been God's doing. What did you see in chapter 30? In chapter 30, you see that Jacob seems to be ascribing the increase of the speckled, the spotted, and the striped to be his little sticks that he's sticking in the gutter, right? He's got some kind of weird husbandry practices that are in place here. That seems to be what Jacob thinks is bringing him good luck here in the situation. So whether Jacob really believes this in verse 12 or not, I don't know. He certainly has not been acting like that. If you really thought that God was doing that, would you bother putting the sticks in the water? I don't think that I would, right? However, whether Jacob believes this or Jacob does not believe this, Jacob is right, right? There is nothing about those sticks in the water that were going to produce any kind of animals that looked like that. That's not how that works, right? It just doesn't happen that way, right? God has been keeping Jacob, though. God has been preserving Jacob. God has been causing Jacob to be blessed despite everything that Laban has done for him. I don't know whether Jacob believes this or not, but he's right. He is right in this situation. God has been the one that has been preserving Jacob's wealth. God has been the one that is preserving that family and giving them what they need to be able to make this exit. God is the one who has been doing this for them. Jacob is right. I don't know whether he's telling the truth or not, whether he believes this or not, but Jacob is absolutely right. This is exactly what has been taking place here. All right? God has been preserving him. In verse 13, Jacob then kind of goes back to the revelation that we got a glimpse of in verse 3. And this is why it's hard to say exactly what's going on here, right? Verse 13, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth. Okay? So if we're following Jacob's argument to this point, it has been this, right? Your father is a cheat, even though I've been doing a stand-up job for him. All right, your father is continuing to cheat. Even though your father has cheated us, God has been looking out for us, right? And has been continuing to bless us and continuing to prosper us, right? And now God has said, it's time for you to go, right? And so Jacob is really taking this two-pronged approach. God has been the one who has been keeping us. God is the one who is telling us to leave, and your father is a cheat, Right, this is the core argument that has been raised here, right? And he's hoping that his wives are going to come along with this, right? He's hoping that his wives are going to agree that indeed our father is a cheat, and if God has told you that it's time to go, we should go, right? We're going to put all of this on him, as it were. Verse 14, the wives agree to this. Now, the wives have no problem with this whatsoever. And I don't know whether Jacob expected that to be the situation or not. Again, I don't know how far to trust Jacob at this point in time. I think he probably thought they needed some convincing, but I don't think they needed that much convincing. Listen to what they say here. Do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Do these women have any emotional ties to their father left at this point in time? No. They do not. I don't know whether this has been something that's been growing in their hearts. I don't know whether they've been dealing with Laban's greed all their lives. And oh my goodness, here we go again. It's hard to say what is going on. They have no ties to their father at this point in their lives. Verse 15, are we not reckoned to him as foreigners? We're no different than someone who's come in from across the way. Right, who Laban has no ties to whatsoever. There's no family bonds that these two ladies are feeling towards their father at this point in time at all. And it seems to come down in verse 15 to, for he has sold us and has also entirely consumed our purchase price. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you. The ladies seem to have had a problem with the way that they got married to Jacob. Typically, at this point in time, in this culture, Jacob would not have served for these two women. He would have paid a price for these women. But Jacob never paid a price for these women. He gave all of his time to Laban, and that's how the purchase price was taken place. So either Laban has taken the proceeds of that and used it all for himself, or the fact that they expected that there should have been some money that came to them, right, as a result of the way that this marriage came out, and it never happened, they seem to feel that Laban has, in fact, cheated them as well. Right, so Laban feels cheated. These two ladies feel cheated. And so their conclusion in verse 16 is that anything that God has given you, any wealth that we have acquired as a result of everything that's happened over the past few years, it's ours. Right, they don't even feel that you should give Dad a little bit of this and then we'll walk away with the rest. They say, what we have, that's ours. And he can just go off. We don't care. We don't care what happens to him. Right? And so whatever God has told you to do, in verse 16, whatever God's told you to do, let's do it. Right? They are perfectly fine with leaving tomorrow. Right? They can pull up the tent stakes, they can fold up the tent, they can stick it on a camel and walk away, and they will feel perfectly fine at this point in time. Right? And so this is exactly what Jacob has wanted. Right? This is exactly what God has told Jacob to do, and everything is falling into place. Right? The argument has gone well. The ladies are on board with this. And so in verse 17, the plot begins to be put into action. With the wives on board, with everyone agreeing that our father is a cheat and that we need to do whatever God has said, then everything begins to fall into place. Verse 17, Jacob arose and put his children and his wives upon camels, and he drove away all his livestock and his property, which he had gathered, his acquired livestock, which he had gathered in Paddan Aram, to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household items that were her father's. And Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him that he was fleeing. So he fled with all that he had, and he arose and crossed the Euphrates River and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. It almost looks immediate, does it not, in verse 17? Doesn't it look immediate? You have the conversation that takes place, we should go. Yep, we should go. They're on the camels immediately, right? Now, it's hard to say. Maybe there was a little bit of time that took place. Surely there is some preparations that would have to be made for this, right? You know that you're going on a long journey. You'd have to have some foodstuffs in line. So surely there is some preparation that has taken place. But there's not a lot of time, right? They're ready to go at this point in time. And so in this point, not only has the plot already been hatched, the plot has been proposed, but now the plot is actually executed, right? We're going to leave. We're going to walk away. And he chooses a very opportune time there in verse 19. Laban had gone to shear his flock. Now, Laban is still a wealthy man. He's not as wealthy as he was because Jacob's been carving out more and more of his wealth. But Laban is still a wealthy man. And shearing sheep takes an awful lot of effort and an awful lot of time. And you end up being far away from your house at this point in time. Easily, it could have taken several hundred men that Laban would have required just to shear his part of the flock, if the flock was as large as we might think that it would be. And you're going to be several days a journey away from your house to make this happen, because you've got to be out where the sheep are to make all this take place. So Jacob has chosen the worst possible time for Laban, right? Laban is occupied. He's got a lot of work that needs to be done in a very short amount of time. He's got a lot of other people with him, so presumably the house is a little bit emptier. There are less eyes around to notice that we're leaving, all right? And Laban is farther away from the house than he would normally be, right? The timing is absolutely perfect to construct this escape. And this is exactly what they choose to do. In fact, Laban is so far away, in verse 22, that Laban doesn't find out that Jacob has left for 3 days. Right? That's how long it takes for news to travel to Laban that Jacob and his family have left. It takes that long to find out because Laban is this far away at this point in time. Right? And so God has preserved Jacob up until this point. Right? He has given Jacob everything that he needs. He has made sure that Laban has not been able to cheat Jacob more than he possibly could. And now Jacob and his family are able to get up and to simply walk away with substantial amounts of property, with substantial amounts of flocks and herds and male servants and female servants and camels. Right? There is a lot of wealth that Jacob has amassed, and he is walking away. Okay? God has preserved Jacob so far. We see here then, as we move into verse 22, that God continues to preserve Jacob. After Laban finds out that Jacob has left, and it takes 3 days for Laban to find out, Laban then goes in, I'll call it hot pursuit, although it takes several days, so it's kind of hard to call it hot pursuit, isn't it? It's one of the slowest chases ever. It kind of reminds you of the O.J. Simpson, you know, kind of cruising through L.A. It takes a very long time for this. Right. He pursues Jacob in verse 23. Then he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey and overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. Okay, so this is roughly a 10-day chase, if we put it out simply. Right, it takes 3 days for Laban to get started. That gives Jacob 3 days to go ahead and get a move on. It then takes Laban another 7 days to catch up with Jacob. Which is kind of impressive, because Jacob has a fairly large amount of animals and stuff and people that are moving with him. Laban seems to just be coming with him and his kinsmen, right? So just a bunch of dudes, right? They should have been able to make pretty good time. So the fact that Laban is taking this long is not very impressive on Laban's part. In the middle of this, in verse 24, God comes to Laban in a dream. Right, verse 24, God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream of the night and said to him, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad." You can very well imagine that Laban is probably spitting mad at this point in time. Right, everything that he probably has feared has taken place. Right, Jacob has walked off with his wealth. Jacob has walked off with his family. Jacob has walked off with grandchildren and his daughters. Jacob has walked off with an awful lot, right? This is everything that Laban has been trying to prevent for quite some time. And Jacob has done it secretly, right? We saw it there in verse 20. Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean. Laban didn't see this coming. Right? Laban may have feared this, but he couldn't have seen this taking place. Jacob should be off probably shearing sheep himself, right? Not walking off with the whole flock like he's doing right now. Right? So Laban, you can imagine, is spitting mad. And if Laban has to pursue someone for 7 days, 10 days, right, to get to this point, you can imagine that his anger is probably just building as he goes along, right? What is he doing as he's going day after day? He's probably just stewing, right? And every step that you take, probably his blood pressure probably just went up another degree, right? And just going and going and going and going. And had Laban probably had his way, by the time he ran into Jacob, who knows what Laban would have done? Laban will even admit later on, he says in verse 29, "It is in my power to do you harm." Laban probably has the superior military force at this point in time. He's got all these kinsmen that have been with him shearing sheep, right? He's got a larger force than Jacob has. Jacob only has sons and some male servants, right? He doesn't have that much. Laban has a superior force that is coming out after him. at this point in time, as the head of the family, as the patriarch, there's really no check on what Laban can or cannot do to Jacob. If Laban wanted to put Jacob to death, he could do it. If Laban wanted to send Jacob away with absolutely nothing, he can do it. This has been exactly what Jacob has been afraid of, right? Laban has all of the cards. Jacob has absolutely nothing. And as Laban is going day after day pursuing Jacob, what do you think his thoughts are? What am I going to do to him when I find him? Boy, I'm going to wring his neck. Boy, I'm going to wring his neck twice. And you can just imagine, it's just getting worse and worse as he's going along. And finally, God puts a check on this in verse 24. Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad. Hands off. Hands off. Whatever it is, Laban, that you've been plotting, whatever it is that you'd like to do to this man, don't do it. Right? And apparently, whatever it is that Laban sees scares Laban enough that when Laban does come to meet Jacob, he doesn't touch him. He says as much, right? In verse 29, it is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night saying, be careful not to speak to either good or bad to Jacob. Laban doesn't even try. Laban won't try this entire time. He's blustering. He's mad. He's probably spitting all over the place. He's so frustrated. But he will not try to do anything. The only thing he even makes an effort for is for these idols. That's the only thing that he makes an effort for. He will not do anything. And it's interesting that he says here in verse 29, but the God of your father. The God of your father. Okay? Jacob will pick up on this later on. Verse 42. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been with me, had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night. If you look at the first part of that verse, the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac, many of your translations will have the word fear capitalized. It's as if the fear of Isaac is being treated as a proper name. Right, you could translate this the fear of Isaac. You could translate this the dread of Isaac. I like the dread of Isaac an awful lot. Right, this has nothing to do with Laban fearing Isaac either. This has everything to do with Laban fearing God. Whatever it is that Laban saw in that dream in verse 24 scared Laban to death. So much so that Laban simply thinks of him as the fear of Isaac. The dread of Isaac, this one who is fierce, this one who is awesome, this one who is majestic, I dare not touch Jacob no matter what I want to do. Laban is that afraid, and Jacob knows it. Jacob picks up on it, right? The dread of my father Isaac. It may be the same dread that that Jacob felt as he was sitting underneath that ladder. Right, as he was sitting there in chapter 28, right? He wakes up and he's afraid at that point in time, right? I think Jacob understands exactly who this is, right? Jacob knows this is God. This is the God who is acting on my behalf. This God who has preserved Jacob thus far, at this point, prevents anything else from happening to Jacob. Though Laban wants to, though Laban desires to, though Laban has every right to do it, according to the legal traditions of the time, Laban dare not touch him because of the dread of Isaac. This is how scared Laban is because of this dream, right? It turns the entire course of events on their head. What Laban could have done, he won't do because of this dread of Isaac. God makes sure that he preserves Jacob, that he preserves his family by scaring Laban to death. So that nothing will happen to Laban, nothing will happen to Isaac at all. Right? He continues to preserve Jacob. He's done it already, and he continues to do it. In the middle of this crisis, and there's much more to come, right? As you look from verses 25, really all the way down to verse 42, there's a long discussion that takes place. And we don't have time to deal with all of it this morning. I've picked out more of the interesting features here. But in the middle of this crisis over whether or not Jacob is going to walk away empty-handed or whether Jacob is going to walk away with his family, in the middle of this crisis comes another small crisis that has been Rachel's doing. While Laban, her father, was away shearing the sheep, Rachel got the bright idea back there in verse 19, and we saw it, to steal the household items that household idols that were her father's. Okay, now we don't know exactly what these were. Idols is probably the best word. It really just means an image, right? So this could have been an image of ancestors. These could be idols that are being worshipped there by Laban. We don't really know. We don't know why she took them. We don't know if they're valuable enough to be taken. We know that her and Leah both feel that their father has cheated them. Is it possible that Laban owes us a little more than these flocks, and so she swipes the idols too and sticks them in her saddle? We don't really know. Is it that Rachel looks at these as good luck charms? Right? We've seen some superstitious elements that have taken place in this family even still. Remember the mandrakes, right? Thinking that something was going to take place there. We've seen that there's been some superstitious elements that have taken place. It may be that Rachel still is not entirely convinced about Jehovah and takes these idols as a form of good luck to keep them safe along the way. We don't know why, but for some reason, Rachel decides we're going to swipe these idols and we're going to walk away with them, right? And this makes Laban mad. Laban comes and accuses Jacob of this in verse 30. Now indeed, you have gone away because you long greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? Why did you steal my idols? Why did you steal these things? You didn't have to steal those things. It's enough that you're walking away. Why add insult to injury, as it were? Jacob replies in verse 31, because I was afraid, I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. The one with whom you find your gods shall not live. What is Jacob promising? You find the thief, we kill him. And what does that mean for Rachel? We kill her, right? Who does Jacob love? He loves Rachel, right? This is the worst possible thing that could take place. Rachel has done something. We don't know why. It's kind of a boneheaded move. She steals these idols. And now Jacob basically offers this vow to Laban saying, you find the thief, we'll kill him. We'll kill him right here on the spot, right? And so Rachel's life is suddenly in danger. Laban is convinced that it's Jacob. Laban thinks that it's Jacob's spite that is causing him not only to walk away with his family, but to walk away with the idols as well. And so Laban assumes that it must be Jacob. And this entire situation unfolds in verse 33. He goes into Jacob's tents first. Then he goes into Leah's tent. Then he goes in the tent of the two maids in verse 33. And finally, he goes into Rachel's tent in verse 34. The narrator is just increasing the tension, right? We're getting warmer, right? We know where the idols are. They're with Rachel. She's the one who stole them, right? And Rachel has to invent this little ploy that I can't get up because it's that time, right? You don't really want to check, right? Don't take a look here, right? And this prevents Laban from checking, right? No one wants to find out what's going on here, right? And Laban passes over. And the end result of this is, first off, that Rachel's life is saved, right? If it had been found with Rachel, it would have been Rachel's head. But if it also had been found that someone had stolen it, then Laban would have had a much stronger claim to everything that he was accusing Jacob of, right? As it is, Laban comes in. He can't find anything, right? He's turned over the entire camp, right? He's gone through every tent imaginable, thinking that someone has to have these idols. And what does Laban walk away looking like? Like an absolute idiot, right? Can you believe any of the rest of the claims that Laban has thrown out there? Hard to believe now, isn't it, right? Because Laban now looks like a fool. In the middle of all of his kinsmen, these people who are supposed to be backing him up, Laban now looks like a fool, right? He cannot find anything. And what does this do for Jacob? It simply strengthens where Jacob's coming from, right? Jacob then goes on the hunt there in verse 36. Then Jacob became angry and contended with Laban. And Jacob said, where is my transgression? Where is the sin that you have hotly pursued me for? Though you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us two. What does Jacob do? He turns this on its head. Jacob's good at this kind of thing, isn't he? Right? He's a deceiver. He knows how to make this work. Like, what have you found? You found absolutely nothing. So what about the rest of these claims? They're empty. You don't need to worry about this. The kinsmen need to decide, and the kinsmen have come up with absolutely nothing. There's no evidence for any of these things, right? Jacob is able to take this, and Jacob then moves from being the inferior to being the superior. Jacob becomes the one who is righteous. Jacob the deceiver becomes the one who is righteous. Jacob, who has walked away from Laban and done so deceitfully, he becomes the one that is righteous, and Jacob knows it here. And even says, finally there in verse 42, God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, and he rendered judgment last night. You're not able to touch me. God prevented you from touching me because he has rendered that my case is right and your case is wrong. Right? Jacob walks away from this situation with a higher ground because God has preserved him. Even though Rachel's over there doing a crime, even though Rachel is doing a sin, God is still preserving Jacob in the middle of all of this, and Jacob walks away with the greater hand than Laban does, right? This becomes apparent in verses 43 and following, and I'll move quickly here. In verses 43 down to 55, we get a covenant that gets made. And this covenant gets made between Laban and between Jacob. But what's important is who asked for this covenant. You see in verse 43, Laban replied to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom you have borne? See, so now come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." Who asked for the covenant? It's Laban. Laban asked for the covenant. You may remember back in chapter 26 when we looked at Abimelech and the Gerarites who come, and they come to Isaac and they said, "Make a covenant with us. Let's make a covenant together." And one of the things that we learned at that point in time is whoever is coming asking for the covenant is the one who's in the weaker position. You're the one who has something to lose. You are the one who has something to fear. By the time you get to verse 43 of chapter 31, Laban is now in the weaker position. He starts off with all the carts. He's got all the men. He's got all the legal responsibility. He's got all the legal rights. By the time we get to 43, Laban is a fool, and he's just sitting there blustering, and he's got nothing left to do. The dread of Isaac has prevented him from doing anything else. He cannot make any of the accusations stick that he has come with, and all he can do is to say, "Can we make a covenant?" Right? This takes Jacob and his family and puts them on par with Laban and his family, right? They are now at the very least equals. They are arguably greater at this point in time. Who has arranged for all of this? It's been God. God is the one who has arranged all of these circumstances. Jacob can't take credit for this, right? Jacob couldn't have accounted for the idols that were stolen by Rachel. As far as we know, Jacob had no idea any of that was taking place because he probably wouldn't have said, "Kill the person who took them," right? It's unlikely that Jacob is in charge of any of the events that are taking place. All Jacob is trying to do is to try to get back to Canaan because God told him, "This is what you need to do." God is the one who has been taking care of everything else. God is the one who has caused Jacob to prosper in the middle of Laban's deceit. God is the one who has come to Laban in the middle of the night and said, "Don't you dare touch Jacob," and has scared him to death so that he would not. God is the one who has preserved the life of Rachel and used Rachel's sin, used her transgression to turn the situation around to Jacob's favor so that Jacob comes out on top. And now God is the one who has arranged it so there is a covenant that is being made where Jacob is now seen as the greater and Laban is now seen as the lesser. God is the one who has done all of this. And all of this goes back to chapter 28. What did God promise that he would do? "I will be with you, and I will not leave you till I have finished what I have promised." Right? This is exactly what is taking place in this chapter. The heap that gets made, the covenant that gets made, the meal that gets made here in verse 55, all of this is simply God's work on display. Right? God has made a promise to Jacob, and he has carried it out, despite their sin, despite their deceptions, despite their own imperfections, despite all of the circumstances that were arrayed against them. God has made this thing happen. God is a God who keeps his promise, and God is a God who is able to exert his power to bring about what needs to take place to take the place, right? The dread of Isaac has made this happen. The fear of Isaac has made this thing happen and brought this thing to pass. This is where the application comes to us, right? If God is able to do this for Isaac, if God is able to do this on the behalf of Jacob, then God is able to do this on our behalf as well, right? That is what this is meant to bring us to. And that's what chapter 31 brings us to, right? Give thanks to him. He is a God who is strong. He is a God who is faithful to his promise. And we see it here today. Let's pray. Father, again, we thank you for what we see in this chapter. We thank you that you are this God. We thank you that you are not these household items, idols that can be godnapped and stolen and stuck in a saddlebag. Father, you are far greater than that. You are a God who is powerful. You are a God who is able to arrange all events to come to exactly what they need to. Jacob certainly would not have felt that way all along as he was out in the heat and in the cold, as he was paying terrible prices to Laban because of things that were happening, but as he walks away, he understands and he knows that this to be true, Right? He understands that you are the one who led him this way. He understands that you are the one who provided all these things for him. He understands that you are the one that brought you to that place. And Father, I pray that we learn from this. I pray that we learn much about you, Father, and we go into our life, we go into our week, Father, with this understanding that you are a powerful God who keeps your promises. Father, may we trust you more as a result of that. May we lean on you as we should because of this. We thank you for this and for your word. Just in my prayer. Amen.